Hi, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut, what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it.
In this episode of The Rut, I sit down with international best-selling author, speaker, and a world leader on the science of positive thinking and goal achievement, Brian Main. Brian's world-leading whole brain success system, goal mapping, is used by blue-chip organizations such as Microsoft, Siemens, Disney, and Coca-Cola, is widely used by successful sports teams, and also used by over 5 million people. Brian's story is remarkable. Brian was born into a traveling family and joined the successful family amusement business until, unfortunately, during the UK recession of the late 1980s, the business collapsed and he lost what seemed like everything: his income, his home, his marriage. He was 29 years old, £1 million in debt, and still relatively unable to read or write. It was at this seemingly low point that Brian discovered the keys to success, that you can change your life by changing your thoughts and feelings about it. Using simple but powerful techniques, Brian learned how to hold positive thoughts by setting goals, and through those goals, he gradually transformed both his life and himself. Here is Brian's story, so please leave all judgment at the door. Brian, welcome to The Rut. How are you?
Yeah, great. And really nice to be with you, mate.
Yes, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I've obviously heard a lot about your work, and we were introduced through my mother, which is always brilliant. You've known her for a while.
I think it's 20 years almost. Wow. Now, getting on that way. And I know that the workshop she came to many years ago was important for her and helped her move along to what she's doing now. So it's been quite a long journey together. Yeah.
Very interesting. You've got a very interesting story, which you go into, I imagine you've gone into thousands of times so far, but I would love to explore this because it's a real up and down roller coaster of a lifetime, which is just brilliant. So what is your story?
I was born into a traveling funfair family. My ancestry go back a few hundred years in the circus and fun fairs. My great uncle was a lion tamer and my great aunt was someone that had the knives thrown at her and stuff. And my parents owned traveling fun fair equipment and went round from place to place. And I was born into that life. And the year I was born, my father could see that that way of life was changing and dying out a little. And the thing that he could see was good business was to take his amusements to the seaside for the summer season and open up for the English tourist trade. And that was 1961. And he went to the south side of the Isle of Wight. And what it meant for me as a child growing up is that each year I would have several different homes. I'd have one home traveling around on the fun fairs for about 4 months each year. And then I'd have a home on the Isle of Wight while we opened up for the summer season for the tourist trade, and we just stayed put at a little place called Ventnor for the summer. And then come September, we would pick up and travel again. And then we had a winter base not far from Heathrow Airport, and that was our place for the cold weather months. When the fair isn't open, we'd do the repair work. In practical terms, it meant I had three sets of friends each year. One on the fairgrounds, one on the Isle of Wight, one over by Heathrow. I had two different schools each year, sometimes more. No school while we travelled. Never went to school very much. Never sat any exams, not ever. And like was typical for my generation of travelling funfair kids, I left school at 13. And it sounds strange to some people when I share the story, but it was what was normal for my generation in that life at that time. Everyone I knew left school at 13. And then, of course, I left with no qualifications, but also unable to read and write properly. And that was partly due to the lifestyle. And there were good teachers, and my parents paid for me to have private lessons. Someone would come to the caravan and work with me. I just couldn't get it. And that's mostly because I've struggled with dyslexia over the years. So partly the lifestyle, partly the dyslexia. Left school at 13. And as is normal for traveling children, I worked with my father and helped build the family business. And I had some success in that, for sure. I took the family business in a new direction. My dad owned amusement arcades on the Isle of Wight. And the new direction I went in was to open a disco. And I actually became the youngest person in England to be given a license, alcohol and entertainments license, at just 18. And I opened the disco and it just took off. It was 1981, beginning of the new romantics sort of wave, and I was young and into it, and I opened a very alternative place, and it became quite famous. It was in all the music magazines. A lot of people came from all over the country, even abroad. And I stayed in that business and run the club I had for 13 years. And I did very well, made a lot of money. I was very rich, very young. I had a lot of fun. But in the late 1980s, early 90s, it all come crashing down. And it was a combination of things that created a bit of a perfect storm in my life, really. One of the main things was tourism ended here on the Isle of Wight. People still come here on holiday, but not in the way they used to, not the big numbers. And the reason for that was that airfare become affordable. So instead of taking a chance on the weather in England and the food and everything, people were going abroad because it was affordable for people. Mm. And in fact, my customers, 18 to 30 year olds, Club Med, they were some of the first to stop coming to the Isle of Wight. They all started going to Ibiza instead, and Falaraki, and various places where they could party all night, and the beer and the wine was cheap, and sunshine was guaranteed, and all the mates were going there. They weren't coming to the Isle of Wight anymore. And then the young family group stopped, and even by the early 90s, the old age pensioners didn't come anymore. And tourism ended, and so did a lot of the old family businesses that were built on tourism. It became a really sad time. All the hotels closed down. Businesses went out of business. My family's business was one of those that went out of business. And I found myself in a situation that I really wasn't prepared for. I went from being worth a lot of money and owning a big house on the seafront and driving a fast red Italian sports car to being £1 million in debt. Everything was repossessed. I lost my home. I signed on to income support for the first time in my life. After everything had been repossessed and sold, I was still in £1 million of debt. It wiped out the whole family. My brother lost his home as well and went bankrupt. And I just didn't know what I was going to do. I was 29 years old. I had no qualifications. I'd only ever worked for myself or the family business. Couldn't read and write. You know, plus I'm £1 million in debt. I was thinking, who the bloody hell is going to employ me? You know, how am I going to live? And all I could see was, well, I can go back to the travelling fun fairs, but even that was going to be hard for me to get some equipment together. I had some relatives reach out and say, look, we'll help you, and we've got an old caravan you can live in. And my parents' home was going to be repossessed. They were 65 at the time, and I just felt so responsible because I'm the oldest son. I just thought, I've got to do something to try and turn things around and make sure they don't end up homeless like me at 65, you know. So, but I just didn't know what I could do. I'd become very dark in my mind, very depressed, very fearful. And I wouldn't leave my bedroom. I went back into my old bedroom in my parents' home, waiting for the repossession people to come. And I just sat on the edge of the bed every day crying, wouldn't go and get help. I haven't thought about it for a while. So there's a lot of people in that situation at the moment with what's going on. And what I look back on now, and I'm saying because of maybe others find themselves in a dark situation, it is often at the darkest just before the dawn. Yeah, when things seem really, really bad, often actually you're at the worst point, and it turns around, and some glimmer of light starts to show. The glimmer of light that came for me, and I didn't recognize it as a glimmer of light at first, was I was offered a job as a salesperson, direct selling, door knocking, you know, cold calling type stuff. And I really didn't want to do it, commission only. I wasn't even sure what that meant, but I quickly learned it means you don't sell anything, you're not earning anything. So I joined them, but I didn't sell a sausage, not a bean. And the reason was I was so bloody negative. People like to buy things from happy and positive people.
Yeah.
You know, and you like to join happy and positive people and be around them. And I was whinging, and I had a chip on my shoulder, really, about how unfair it was that my life had crashed and my wife had left and everything had gone wrong. And I was blaming everyone for it rather than taking responsibility and really doing something about it. Mm. And the sales company I joined, the reason why it became a glimmer of light in my life was that they put on a personal development, positive thinking workshop for the team to boost morale and results. And I really didn't want to go, is the truth of it. I thought personal development and positive thinking was a lot of new age fluffy stuff. Mm. But I was given the choice of going to the workshop or leaving the team. And so I went to the workshop, and my mind was very closed. But the guy they brought in to run the workshop, and he was something of a pioneer in the UK, teaching practical positive thinking strategies and science 40 years ago when nobody else was thinking of doing. And he just made it very simple. He made it very simple, and it was very difficult to argue with the things he was saying. They just made common sense. Mm. And the thing that really turned it around for me was that he explained the simple brain science that sits behind the surface level of positive thinking. And once I understood why it works, that when you hold a positive thought in your mind, whether that's about yourself, your life, your situation, your future, that positive thought creates like an impulse, like a vibration that starts in the middle of your brain cell. And the brain cells have like arms or branches, like fingers coming out from your hand. And the positive impulse travels out along those. And from the end of them, it stimulates the release of a chemical called serotonin, which is the happy chemical. It's the feel-good chemical. It's the same chemical that's released if you take an antidepressant or a party drug. And I'd had a rave dance club, so I knew a little bit about serotonin. The other major function of serotonin is that it acts as a neuroconductor. So when you release serotonin from the end of the brain cells, it helps form connections between your brain cells, which in turn, as you make more and more connections between your brain cells, you have that aha moment. Not only are you feeling good because of the serotonin release, but you're starting to see answers to problems. You're having that light bulb moment where suddenly you're going, oh yeah, I could do this. And through the release of the serotonin, it gives you the feel good motivation to take your new idea, take a brave step forward, go do something with it. Henry Ford famously said, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right. Because in thinking you can, you actually start the neurological process that helps you find a way and the motivation to make the journey. But if you think you can't, then you probably won't. Because as soon as you start to think negatively, the negative impulse releases a different chemical called cortisol, which gives you the feeling of sadness and depression. And it's a neuroinhibitor. It shuts the brain down. This is part of our fight or flight response that's evolved over thousands of years, that when we were confronted by a wild animal that wanted to eat us, we'd release cortisol, shut down our secondary systems, turbocharge our muscles with adrenaline release, and our brain would shut down. So we just focused on the problem, that hungry bear that wants to eat me for lunch. And all the saved energy would allow us to either fight that bear or run away really fast and climb a tree. And it's through the physical exercise of running or fighting that we burn off the cortisol and release the serotonin and rebalance our brain chemistry. And it works very well for surviving that type of danger. But in modern life, it's very counterproductive because the fears we have in modern life about not having enough money or whether we are good enough or will my partner stick with me or will they leave? Am I going to have my income next month? My children are going to be okay. When we worry about those things, our brain responds in the same way as if there's real danger, and it releases the cortisol and it shuts our brain down and the problem looks bigger and our body starts to become stressed because we're releasing these chemicals for fight or flight, but we're not actually fighting and we're not running away either because it's not the type of danger to run away from. We're simply sitting and worrying. And that's why when people go into that type of stress, it makes them sick. And in learning this, I really had the light bulb moment that this was information that could not only help me boost my sales career, earn some money, pay off my debt, but actually if I applied the same strategy of positive thinking and brain cell connections to my ability to learn to read, it could help me with that. And that actually became my first big goal, was to learn to read in terms of a conscious goal, because we're all of us setting goals all of the time. But in terms of, you know, taking a goal, thinking it through and recording it in some way so that you become conscious of it, mindful of it, my first big goal was learning to read. And thankfully, the guy that was teaching me all this stuff, he took a liking to me and he helped me and he became my coach.
Let's just go back to that workshop. Because I'm just interested to quickly explore, why do you think that had such an impact on you? Because let's face it, Brian, that workshop changed your life.
Yeah, I was at a rock bottom. There were other people in the workshop that liked it, and some of them used some of it, and they did well from it, but they didn't have perhaps the turbo effect it had on me because they weren't in such a place of need. It came at a very important time for me, and I'd lost my confidence. And this guy was very genuine, very sincere. His name was Mike Rosewarne. He sadly died quite young, but I had him as my coach for some years. He understood a lot of important things and he made them very simple, and he was sincere. I trusted him. And so when he said to me, look, you can turn this situation around, I believed him. And I'd had teachers say to me, and they were well-meaning teachers, but when I was young, I had teachers say to me, Brian, you'll never learn to read and write. Because I used to get upset because I couldn't do what the other children were doing. And they would say to me, don't get upset. You'll never learn to read and write because you have this dyslexia. But you're really good at other things. You can make things, do things. But because they were teachers, I believed them when they said you'll never learn to read and write. It became my belief. And it became actually my limitation. And then I met this guy and I believed him more than the teachers. And when he said, look, you'll turn this around, what he actually did was gradually help me believe in myself. Sometimes we need somebody else to believe in us a little bit, to give us that extra sort of boost to find the belief in ourselves. And gradually, as we start to hold a positive picture and move forwards towards the things that are important to us, we build our belief in ourselves more and more. But quite often it's somebody else believing in us that may be the starting place of it.
This workshop is where really your idea for goal mapping started or was created. So after you've learned to read and write, And then presumably you've thought, okay, well, this is pretty useful now. Let me go and try and implement this in a positive way. So how did the goal mapping structure and creation of goal mapping as a principle come about?
Yeah.
And what is goal mapping as well?
So what happened was that I used all the techniques that this guy was teaching, and I simple techniques about positive thinking and motivation and things, and I used them in all the areas of my life, but fundamentally to help myself learn to read. And once I could read, like you said, I thought, yeah, this is pretty useful. And what this guy encouraged me to do was only to read nourishing material, personal development, self-improvement, some spirituality, and not to waste my time reading things like the newspaper, because it was mostly bad news. And I realized very quickly that what was important was not just knowing personal development, but having some techniques to apply it. Mm. It's like knowing it's good to go to the gym, but not going to the gym, it does nothing for you. And you can know personal development, but not apply it, and it really doesn't do much for you. But if you learn how to apply it, it can work wonders. And so I become very interested in techniques, and gradually I was spending more and more time sharing those techniques with other people, because my results rose from the lowest person in the team to the highest by using the different techniques. I was more confident than I'd ever been. My life started to turn around. I started to pay off the debt. People want to know, well, how have you done that? And I started making presentations, and that led on to me switching from being in sales to starting to run training programs. And I got recruited by a London organization. I worked for an American trainer called Tony Robbins, and then afterwards for another American trainer called Stephen Covey. And I would deliver both corporate training and public training. But the question that was in my mind, it sort of dominated my thoughts day in and day out, was why are we not teaching this simple science of positive thinking and feeling and effective goal setting to our children as standard in state education? In the presentations I'd been making within the first year or so of being a trainer, I lost count of how many people said to me, I so wish somebody had shown me this when I was young at school. And of course, that had been my thought. Why wasn't I shown this? For me, it was like the magic key that set me free. And I started to wonder, why are we not teaching it in schools? And is it because nobody's really defined a simple process for children to follow? And what is the best way? Because it seems that setting goals is something that some people really learn how to do well and other people struggle with. And there are different ways. So what's the most effective way? And I only read books about goal setting for about a year. And I spoke to all the experts around the world. And thankfully, a lot of them would respond to me, because I was working for two very famous trainers with Tony Robbins and Stephen Covey. And about a year or so in, I was driving my car late one night, and I suddenly had this flash in my mind where I saw a goal map, the technique that I'd been teaching now for 25 years. And what I saw, a goal map looks a little bit like a tree, if you like. There's like a trunk and then a centerpiece and some branches and arms that come off. And a goal map is always created using words and pictures. The reason why using words and pictures together in a balanced combination is important is because it helps to stimulate both the logical mind that likes to think in words, as well as the creative mind that likes to think in pictures. And that creative mind is also connected to the subconscious mind, which works like our own personal autopilot, whereas the words and the logical mind are much more connected with the conscious mind. And we need to activate these two aspects of our mind. And the logical conscious mind is more associated with the left side of the brain, and the creative subconscious mind is more associated with the right side of the brain. And by stimulating the whole brain using a combination of words and pictures when you set goals, it helps the person to be clear about what they want. And also, like a form of self-hypnosis with the imagery, to command their subconscious mind to move them towards the goal. And it took me some months to work out what I'd actually seen in my flash of insight, because I saw the map in words and pictures complete in its entirety. It wasn't that I sat down and gradually created it. I saw it complete and then needed to reverse engineer and understand what it was that I'd seen. But I had such a strong feeling and knew intuitively in the moment it was an answer to my question, that if we're going to set goals in a very, very powerful way, we need to use this balanced combination of words and pictures and to go through a series of steps covering the important aspects of conscious creation and achievement if we're to give ourselves the best opportunity of moving towards the things we desire and achieving our conscious goals.
Why is goal setting so impactful psychologically? What's the psychology of goal setting?
When you set a goal, what is going on at a physical level is that you're actually helping to join together the brain cells. Brain cells that fire together, wire together. So every time you think about your goal that you have for the future, every time you tell yourself you're going to do it, every time you mention it publicly, you're demonstrating faith in yourself. All of that gradually establishes the brain cell connections. And as you do that, what you're actually doing is you're forming new beliefs. So when you have that aha moment, you say, oh, I'm going to do this. That's the joining of two or more brain cells. Now, at first, they break apart again. But if you repeat the same thought over, if you remind yourself, you reestablish that brain cell connection, and gradually, like a bit of tacky glue, they start to stick together. And at first, the connection's a little bit weak. And so it's the equivalent of having an opinion, or I think I'm going to do it. And then gradually, as the connection becomes more and more established by you imagining what it is you want to achieve and telling yourself you're going to do it, the connection grows stronger and becomes a belief. And then longer still, it becomes a conviction. And the stronger the brain cell connection, the greater the command it's sending on a constant basis to your subconscious about either the way that you choose to be or the desires that you choose to move towards in life. From a psychological basis, mentally, it's you holding a positive picture of your future so that your subconscious is moving you towards that rather than you holding a negative picture of your future. Because if you do and it becomes dominant, your subconscious will move you towards that. It's a strange insight for some people, but the reason why people go into some form of self-sabotage is because they're actually thinking too often about what they don't want. And your subconscious mind doesn't understand the don't bit. It's like an autopilot. It's almost mechanical. It follows your strongest thought. If you observe very young children and you tell them don't touch, they touch. And if you're thinking about what you don't want, you're actually forming a picture in your mind of what you don't want. Your subconscious moves you towards that and you get more of what you don't want. And so it's very important to be clear about what you do want. And to have that down the form of a goal and remind yourself of it in a gentle way, balanced way. And every time you're thinking about what you want, not only are you sending that thought command to your subconscious to move you towards it, but invariably by thinking about the things that you want and imagining them a little, you release more serotonin and help yourself to feel better. Because every time you think about what you don't want or you hold a picture of fear in your mind about your possible future, you'll be releasing cortisol and you'll be making yourself feel down. Either down in your self-esteem, or down in your emotions, or dragging your body down. Because when we release a lot of cortisol, it really affects our immune system. And when it drags it down, and when we think positively, we release serotonin, which builds our immune system up. And this is why humor is often used now within medicine, and of course was in ancient times as well with the Greeks.
We are Loose Heads, the rugby leisurewear brand, helping to raise awareness for mental health.
100% of the money raised by our foundation goes towards tackling the stigma.
You can find us at looseheads.co.uk or at looseheads on all social media platforms. You can now enter code RUT for 10% off your next order. Together, let's tackle the stigma. Take care. Go safe.
This segues quite nicely into how goal mapping can be used to ease depression and anxiety, and in many cases lift it. So I'm interested to understand what happens in the brain when we're depressed and how that process is then reversed using goal mapping.
Generally, when we become depressed, we're caught in a bit of a loop. In psychology, it's often called cybernetic loop. And it's simply that your thoughts and your feelings and your physiology or body posture are all connected. And when we make a change in one, it will affect the others. So if you start to think in sad and negative ways, you release cortisol both from your brain and from glands in your body, and it makes you feel sad and anxious and fearful. In addition, your body posture will change. Your shoulders will come forward, your head will go down, your face will frown, your breathing becomes shallow and restricted. And again, if you watch any young child that is on a sad one, you'll see the whole body posture, and teenagers likewise, it's all down. And if you picture someone who's very sad and depressed, you can see their body posture, and maybe you can connect with this because you felt this way yourself. With all three being the way that they are, it holds us in a low place. It's like one triggers the other, triggers the other. And we find ourselves sinking into a rut, doing ourselves physical harm, both in the amount of negative chemicals we're releasing, which are only meant to be for a short time. In fight or flight. And by running, we burn off the cortisol. But when we sit and we become very depressed, or we lay in bed and we don't feel like we can get up because the body's feeling like concrete, one thing is triggering the other, and we get caught in this rut, in this pattern. Goal setting is a way of breaking ourselves out of the rut. One of the mistakes I think that is common with a lot of people when they aren't really understanding the science of goal setting is they think that goal setting is something that you do once a year, New Year's Eve, to set some resolutions for the coming year. Actually, what goal achievement is all about is having a daily routine where you are clear about what's really important to you in your life. It's not about pursuing the goal in a hard and fast way. Quite often with goal setting, we need to be flexible with the time, give ourselves more time, and not put ourselves under huge stress, because that becomes counterproductive. But it's important to have that clarity about where you want to go in your life and why. And then to be gradually moving towards it on an ongoing basis. A goal map has a number of elements. So what do you want to achieve? What's the priority? Because there may be many things. What does it look like if you picture it? Why do you want it? When? How are you going to do it? And who's going to help you? Now, I've got one of my goal maps in my hand. And I create them for different things. So I will have a goal map for my health and well-being. I'll have a goal map focused just on happiness. I'll have another about self-esteem. Of course, I have them for business things.
Let's talk about that goal map for happiness and self-esteem, because actually it's been a common theme in the conversations that I've had now, a lot of them with various different men, is understand that, a lot of them understand that they struggle with their self-esteem, but they also have a real issue with identifying ways to improve their self-esteem other than the negative triggers or negative ways in which they try to improve it. That might be with alcohol, sex, etc., etc. So what is the basis of that happiness goal map? How does that work?
It's fundamentally tied in with understanding self-esteem, self-image, and how the two together create your self-concept. At a simple level, the goal map is focused on authentic happiness. Mm. And most people experience casual happiness. Casual happiness is the type of happiness that comes sometimes unexpectedly, because your day just happens to turn out in a way that you believe is good. And something's happened and you go, oh, I'm happy about that. Or you've achieved something that you consider as special and it makes you happy. But it's invariably the outside thing that is the trigger for you being happy internally. Authentic happiness turns that around on its head. Authentic happiness is that you are working with your mind in how you choose to think about yourself and life in order to be happy regardless of whether the day or your life is going the way that you would wish it. And so it's about taking a very conscious focus. You make a choice about what you're going to focus on. And sometimes you've got to play a little glad game where you work to find what can be good about the situation. Because there are days when stuff comes and you just go, I can't see anything positive in that.
Absolutely.
Until you work with your mind. And if you will work with your mind and you learn some techniques and some quality questions to ask yourself, and one for me is, what can be great about this? And it makes me work sometimes to find that great thing, but invariably I find it. And by focusing on what's great about whatever it is that's gone on or happened, that helps me to feel happy in an authentic way. Mm. But it's not just about, oh, well, I want to go through my day feeling happy. It's also about the serotonin release forming the connections and thereby giving me the insight so that I can see a better way forward, feel more motivated and get more done. And in balance to that, let me just say that there are times when it's absolutely right and necessary to allow yourself to be sad. One of the mistakes I made in my early years of personal development was that I didn't allow the sadness to come out that was there. And when you cover over suppressed emotion, it doesn't really go away. It forms emotional blocks and it will often resurface in other ways like illness. And there's a lot of research now around psychosomatic illness. If something happens in your life that there is a genuine a requirement to be sad, it's fine to be sad. When my dad died, I was very sad about that for a long time. However, even in that situation, chose to think about what can be great. And I focused on how grateful I was to have had him for 46 years and what a great dad he was, rather than on how terribly he had been taken from me. And so the tears were often tears of gratitude rather than bitterness. But of course, it's still important we allow that sadness out. And I certainly have in the last couple of years. And it's a strange thing for me that quite often I will get emotional, like I did on the interview earlier. And sometimes that happens when I'm on stage talking about the work that I do, even in front of a couple of thousand people. And I've learnt that it's okay. And it's much better, actually, to let things out rather than hold them in, but not get caught in the rut of going through the same sad thoughts over and over and over and over, because that rut is what forms depression. Mm. Having a goal map, and it doesn't have to be my technique, goal mapping, it can be anything, but if you've got a goal, if you've got a picture, if you're telling yourself that you're okay and you're starting to focus on what's right, it's the way to pull yourself out of that rut or to stop yourself going back into one. But self-image is all about the inner image we hold of ourself. It's made from all the different brain cell connections and beliefs and opinions, and we form this inner picture of who we are and the way that we act in life. It's like a little movie picture going on the inside of our mind, and our subconscious reads that picture every moment of every day to keep us the same. The way that all your habit patterns and ways of being are regulated is that your subconscious is constantly reading a picture of you, your self-image, to help you stay the same every day. Staying the same is easy. We easily form habit patterns of thinking, feeling, behaving, routines. And what's important is that we learn how to influence those consciously so that we are creating habit patterns that serve us rather than limit us, hold us back. To do it fully, we need to understand how the self-esteem forms. And in essence, the challenge for so many people with their self-esteem is that they have, as a child, been overly compared, either to other children or to criteria such as exams. And when a young child, children crave unconditional love. Not love because you've been as good as some expected standard, as good as your brother, as good as your sister, as good as that kid down the road, or as good as that exam test that we want you to pass. And when children are overly measured and compared, they start to form an understanding, a knowingness at a really deep level. I'm not loved just for being me. I'm only loved when I'm as good as. When I'm as good as this brother, sister, test, whatever, and I'm not as good as them. I'm being told I've got to get better to be as good as them. And there's always another level to reach. And they are obviously better than me. I'm not as good as them. I've got to improve to become as good as them. This person I'm being compared to, I'm not as good as them. They are better than me. I am less than them. The feeling of being worth less than somebody else in childhood grows gradually into the inner feeling of worthlessness. Mm-hmm. Worthlessness. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough, and nothing I do is fucking good enough. And it in adult life tends to take two prime forms, introverted and extroverted. Introverted, low self-esteem, I'm not good enough, or my opinion's not worth anything, and I'm just going to sort of try and hide into the shadows and be a bit of a wallflower, and you can see they're crushed. Other children will fight back against the feeling I'm not good enough, but they become unbalanced in the process, and they normally become extroverted and have this I'm better than you attitude. And it's often mistaken as confidence, but it's really bravado. Mm-hmm. And either person is trapped in the comparison game, where if they think they're doing better than somebody else, then they're happy. Or if they think they're not doing good enough, they're sad. But really authentic happiness is about moving beyond that and understanding how your self-esteem is formed and understanding that at your core, you are always good enough. And the only person you ever need to compare yourself to is yourself. And all the time you're happy with yourself and comfortable with yourself, you're growing. And every time you start to look for the flaws in yourself, find fault in yourself, compare yourself, then you're holding yourself back and you're sending the wrong commands. And it's a little hard to understand and to see in ourselves sometimes. I always aim to make it as simple as possible. It's part of the deeper content that I run in my programs. And then I have a slightly different mapping system called life mapping, which is really focused on helping a person grow their self-esteem by sending the command to their subconscious about how they want to feel, about being their true self. And so whether we're setting goals on what we want to achieve in our life or we're setting goals about how we want to feel in ourselves, it's the same basic principle that we want to command the subconscious and we want to be clear in our conscious mind about what's really important.
I want to move into purpose and fulfillment, because actually you mentioned their life mapping. It's really the basis of understanding your own purpose and what you're going to be fulfilled by in life, which in a very utopian sense is what really builds happiness, as you've talked about it, authentic happiness. Why do people innately feel the need to have a purpose? Why is that?
I teach in my work that there are three levels of purpose. What most people hold as a purpose would be explained as a life purpose. So for most people, when you talk to them about purpose, they're thinking about life purpose. And it's something they're going to commit themselves to and move towards. The starting place for me is there is a deeper level of purpose, and I call it prime purpose. Prime purpose really is the purpose we're born with, which is to be all we can be. Now, in other life forms, there isn't really a choice around it. So go look at a tree. The tree is being the best tree it can be. It doesn't have a lot of free will around that. It's the drive of evolution that causes it to be the very best tree. And it's likewise in other life forms. In humans, we have this really high level of free will. And while we are born with that drive of evolution inside of us to be all we can be, not everybody gets the start in life that they need to grow strong. Often the love is lacking. People turn towards negative thinking and beliefs sometimes about themselves. And instead of being all they can be, they are much less than that. And instead of choosing to be their best, in many cases, they're actually being their worst. And so the very first level of purpose, prime purpose, is to have a purpose that you will be all you can be. Not trying to be better than other people, just being your best in a gentle way on an ongoing basis in all the areas of your life and really for all the years to come. By being your best in yourself, it helps you to do your best and achieve your best. And so then what will you place your focus on in life? And really that's where the next level of purpose comes, which is to have a life purpose, something you're going to commit yourself to and maybe for a long period of time. Sometimes a life purpose can be just for a short period. Often it will be for a lifetime. And it's more than a goal. The difference between a purpose and a goal is a goal will have a specific achievement date. So by this time, 2 years' time, I want to achieve X. And a purpose is much more of an ongoing journey. And it will end one day. but you don't really have a defined point around that. And it can be different for different people. So sometimes the purpose may be to be the best mother, father, brother, sister we can be. Or sometimes it's our career, or sometimes it's coaching a sort of a sports club, a junior football team. It's lots of things for lots of people. But it's something physical we're going to do that we're passionate about. And my distinction on it very often is it's the thing that makes our heart sing. So when we find that thing that makes our heart sing, that thing that we love, that we're passionate about, it doesn't feel like work anymore. And it means that we go the extra distance and we learn more about it and we really do it well because we love doing it. It feels like a gift. And so we give it, and normally we will get a lot back in return because the people that love what they do normally become very good at it and are well rewarded for it. And then there's another level of purpose again, which is higher purpose. The higher purpose is simply that you want to leave the world a better place than you found it. Maybe just your very little bit of it, that you're going to try and improve things in some way within your own little circle of influence. Maybe you're looking to play a bigger game, try and make a big difference. For me, many years ago, I was so grateful to this guy that helped me turn things around by learning positive thinking that I wanted to do the same for others. And it was an overnight success. It took me 10 years to pay back my debt, but it did secure my parents' home and my brother helped as well. And the family rallied round and things turned out amazingly well. And the goal mapping system has gone on to reach 5 million people now. And 1 million of those are school children because I created a children's version as well as there being an adult's version.
How does that feel, reaching 5 million people from where you were?
Yeah, it does feel really good. I wouldn't have believed I would have achieved it at the beginning. And not many of my family would have believed it either. And not because they were judgmental or those things, simply because I'd only recently learned to read and write and it just seemed like a big dream to have. But I did hold the picture in my mind quite early on that I would go on. I didn't quite believe I'd be as successful as I have. The other thing is, if I had known at the beginning the difficulties I would face, I probably wouldn't have taken the journey. The thing that's, I believe, important about being clear on purpose, particularly a sense of purpose about what you want to do in life, is if you're really, really connected to it, it will cause you to face fears that you would otherwise shy away from if you were simply doing it for the money. This is my job, I'm doing it for an income. If that was true for me, I would have never faced the things I've faced. It hasn't always been easy. And I think that's probably just right and natural, because part of the great value in having a purpose is that you grow a great deal. And this is the real value in goal setting. A lot of people, I believe, don't fully understand it. The greatest prize in goal setting is not really in the achievement of the goal. In fact, it's not even about achieving the goal. It's really about having a goal. Because all the time you have something that's passionate, it will cause you to step outside of your comfort zone and into the unknown. And you will try some new things, you will do some new things, you will learn some new things, and you will grow as a person. That's the real prize. And achieving the goal is actually secondary, and the value that comes from that. If you study the psychology and the results of people that have been self-made millionaires, etc., and it's just one measure, obviously, of success with the material substance. But often what you'll see when you study cases of millionaires is they sometimes take a risk and they try something new and it goes wrong and they lose their fortune. And normally within 3 years, they've made it all back. It may have taken them 20 years first time round, try something new, they lose it, and within a couple of years, they've made it all back. Why? Because they've already become the person that believes they can. In achieving the goal the first time round, they built the belief that they could do it. Of course, they learned a lot of skills and made a lot of good contacts, but it was also that knowingness they've done it once. And so they normally pull it all back together again very quickly, and sometimes more. And so having that sense of purpose causes us to grow, and we face new things, and we step out of our comfort zone, and we invariably learn more, and we get more from it, and it gives more. And so for me, teaching people what I learned that helped me turn things around, and it's an ongoing journey. I've had some really difficult years, even in recent times, because of course life is always changing. And so learning personal development doesn't mean that you never face any difficult times ever again. It simply means that you have the tools to help yourself out of tough situations and to, you know, reduce the amount that comes. You stop creating them for yourself, you know, and have the tools to get out of them if they come along your path.
I always say that purpose, well, I've begun to realize that purpose and fulfillment together equals happiness. And what's your definition? Well, first and foremost, how do purpose and fulfillment differ? But then how are they linked to form happiness, and how does that impact human life?
I think fulfillment comes as we step along the path of our purpose. So with each significant step we take along the path that we believe is our purpose in life, the thing that we're passionate about, meant to do, it gradually adds to our level of fulfillment. I had some really challenging times in 2018 when a number of things changed in my life, and it was holding on to the sense of purpose and continuing along that path invariably, regardless of how difficult the day was, that really helped me pull through it. And with each step, knowing that I was still giving and doing the things that I felt I was meant to do, it helped me more and more in terms of that feeling of fulfillment. And when we don't have that, then I think that's when we are really in danger of becoming lost. A quote came to my mind just now, I don't know who it's by, but a difficult time is more readily endured when one has a definite sense of purpose, because it gives us something to hold on to and to aim for. I know that in the Vietnam War, when American prisoners were captured and they were interrogated by Chinese military, they were asked a series of questions, but one of the key questions was, do you have a sense of purpose, a faith in yourself? And the American prisoners that were deemed to have a strong sense of purpose and faith in themselves were put into maximum security camps with guard towers and high fences and armed guards, etc. But the American prisoners that were deemed to have no sense of purpose were put into an open clearing in the jungle, miles from anywhere, but with no guards, no fence, nothing. And nobody ever escaped from the open clearing. People only escaped from the maximum security camps. And whether your challenge is that you're an American prisoner of war in Vietnam, or you're finding yourself a prisoner at home in the COVID-19 lockdown, holding that sense of purpose, defining it for yourself, invariably means you find a way to keep going. You find a way out. You will pull through the difficult period. But if you have no sense of purpose, if you're just thinking my life's not worth anything, I'm not worth anything, if you don't know why you're here or have a reason for it, you don't value yourself then. And then that's when you really do, I think, sink down into a very deep rut, a very deep depression, often accompanied with anxiety because you're fearful about the future.
I want to stress that goal mapping, life mapping, and the other offshoots of the overall brand of goal mapping by Brian Main does not need to happen when we're down and depressed or anxious. It can happen at any stage of your life. You could be just looking at how your life is moving forward or what you'd like out of life. It can be done at any stage of your, I suppose, emotional spectrum. And that's really important, isn't it?
Yeah, look, setting goals is an ongoing thing, and it's actually really easy to set goals when you're feeling great. It's a little bit more challenging.
It is, yeah.
It requires free, you know, you applying your free will to set goals when you're feeling a bit down. I have huge clients in the world that use goal mapping. Microsoft's one of my biggest clients. Siemens, Disney, Coca-Cola, British Telecom, Barclays Bank. I can reel off a long list of corporate clients, and they're not having goal mapping because their people feel down, although some people do appreciate it for that reason because they can use it to help them if they are feeling a bit down. It's employed by those big organizations to help people reach even higher levels of success. And in the same way, we have a lot of athletes that use goal mapping, including some world champions that use goal mapping and testify that it gave them an edge. It helped to program their subconscious mind, just like an intense form of visualization, and help take them to another level. Salespeople, leaders of all types, a lot of people within multi-level marketing. There are just people all over. And of course, the children's program goes out into state schools to help students increase their grade averages and aim for a brighter future where they're going to take on a career that is going to make their heart sing, something they really want to do. So it's used in a lot of different ways by different people. And obviously, we've got to focus at the moment in how it helps people mentally and emotionally, because I really feel that at this time there are going to be more people than ever struggling in that way. And it's a very simple thing to create a map. But it is, and I'm loving talking to you, and I really hope it's helping the audience who listen or maybe view some of the video that we've captured. But actually, it's creating the map that's the most important thing, not listening to me. Good to know a little of it, understand it. I think that adds power. If you can understand how something works and why it's important, it gives you more emphasis on using it. But it is in creating the map and then looking at it once a day. And as you look at the pictures, you say the words, stimulate both sides of the brain, and make it a little ritual for yourself. First thing in the morning is the best time, because when you first wake up, the connection to your subconscious is much stronger. You're in a brain state called alpha rhythm for the first hour. And so what you look at and what you say to yourself in that first hour is quite important. So have your map up on the wall somewhere. And just for a few moments, look at the pictures, say the words. It helps re-establish those brain cell connections, releases serotonin, gives you a good start to the day, sends a command to your subconscious about what's important to move towards. So you start to notice opportunities and feel motivated to do the things you need to do. And there's not been a lot of marketing or anything like that of the system over the years. It's been people creating maps, achieving goals, being wowed by that.
Word of mouth growth, right?
Yeah, and then recommending me to others. Even Microsoft came to me on a recommendation from an executive that had used it, was impressed with it.
Really? And,
So it's been amazing, really. And it's why I make the material free for people to go and use. People can download the paper templates, print them out, and simple instruction and draw their map, or they can use the free online software and they can create the map on the software, which is what most people prefer these days. And for their children as well, there's free children's material. But it is doing the map that works the magic.
I'm going to put the website in the show notes for when this episode goes out. But obviously, it's www.goalmapping.co.uk, right?
.com. Yeah,
goalmapping.com. You can download your free goal maps on there and do them yourself and use the templates, which is amazing. So Brian, thank you so much for coming on. What an amazing episode. And I really, really hope that people who are, it's so important right now as well with people being furloughed, losing their jobs, really sitting back and using lockdown as a time for self-reflection and understanding what's important. I was on a call the other day with somebody who was doing exactly that and said he's never really done it before, but lockdown is giving him the opportunity to reassess his life, his purpose, what makes him happy, and he's going to make some significant changes. And if people are in need of doing this, then I think it's really important they give goal mapping a shot, as it's clear that it works. I mean, 5 million people would not have used the system and gained benefit if it didn't work, right? So let's get people, first and foremost, let's get people talking about their problems, and then also let's get people moving out of a bad headspace, a depressive state, an anxious state by doing something about it. And actually, it's by taking accountability of your life and your actions. Nobody else can do it. You can go to all the therapy sessions in the world, as I can attest to. It's unless you actually sit there and think, right, I've got to do this. And you have a purpose for doing that. And you're then gaining fulfillment, but you have a map of why you're going to do it. That's the most important. So, Brian, thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, James.
And we'll do it again soon.
Be my pleasure. Take care, my friend.
Take care. Thanks for listening to that episode of The Rut. Please give us a subscribe if you haven't already, and find us on Twitter and Instagram through @TheRutPod for more updates on who's coming on the show next. Special thanks to my team, Ricky Batchew and Phil Bateman, for helping me produce this podcast. Next time on The Rut, I sit down with Wasps rugby players Jack Willis and James Gaskell. See you then.